We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Lind, who is the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's the co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. Among his other nonfiction books are The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. His latest book just out is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Thank you.
And of course, in talking about the economic history of the United States, at this moment at the G8 summit in Camp David, the president, with the rest of the world leaders, particularly the European leaders, is basically saying to Angela Merkel, save my political future by getting your act together. So at least in the political sense, America's economy is extremely vulnerable.
Well, that's right. The world is recovering from the aftermath of a colossal assets bubble in housing in the U.S. and other countries, most of which were trade deficit countries. The countries that ran the trade surpluses, like Germany in Europe, China and Japan, really need to do much more to sponsor consumption among their own people, because the American consumers are tapped out. The American consumers drove the world economy during this bubble economy by borrowing money in order to buy goods, many of them imports, from export countries like Germany and China. And unless the Chinese, as well as the Germans, the two leading export economies in the world, increase their domestic demand to make up for the shortfall of Americans' demand, now that Americans are trying to pay down their credit card bills and in some cases sell their houses, then you're going to have flat or negative global demand for years to come, and that will affect the United States as well as Asia and Europe.
So given what you've just told us, Michael Lind, why is the debate then about deficits and austerity here in the United States and not about creating demand? I mean, it sounds like we're afflicted by ideology, you know, outdated and non-applicable ideology, and, you know, we're out of step with economic literacy.
Well, what happened was there was a profound philosophical shift, not only in the United States, but in the Western world, that took place in the 1970s and 1980s, from the Great Depression and World War II all the way up until the 70s, the U.S. and the European countries more or less followed the tenets of demand-side economics, of which Keynesianism is a part. They were terrified that after World War II, the world would sink back into depression, and so they undertook reforms such as higher wages for workers, pro-unionization policies, social insurance to make sure that non-workers, like retired people, had plenty of income, simply to keep the whole mechanism of consumption going, because they understood that unless you have customers, then your businesses are not going to have, or that your businesses need customers, and the customers require income. What happened in the 1970s was the triumph of supply-side versions of economics. What we think of as supply-side economics, the Reagan-era theory that cutting taxes will lead to higher tax revenues, which has been discredited, that's simply one kind of supply-side economics. The so-called neoliberal Democrats, including Robert Rubin and Bill Clinton, have pushed their own democratic version of supply-side economics, which says we need to invest in the supply side of the economy in terms of human capital and technological R&D. And we don't need to worry that much about the demand side. So you had this situation for 20 or 30 years where the liberals as well as the conservatives were neglecting the demand side and focusing on the supply side. And in order to question this, you have to go against the orthodoxy not only of conservative Republicans and conservative Christian Democrats in Germany, but also against Tony Blair Labor Party people and Bill Clinton Democrats.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Lind, the author of a new book just out, Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. So Given that we're in this situation, I mean, I take it you're suggesting we're in a kind of no man's land at this point. Obviously, the mantra about cutting taxes and raising all boats has been discredited.
You know, but so has been the left's version of the supply side economics, which is sending everyone to college, right? Unless you have decent jobs with adequate wages, and with the adequate wages and the adequate benefits supporting mass consumption, then everyone can get a PhD, and it's not going to help the economy. So this broader supply-side consensus with the left's emphasis on training and education, as well as the right's emphasis on tax cuts, I think has been discredited.
So when do we get away from discredited ideology into proffering something that actually works, which I take it is what you're trying to do in Land of Promise?
Well, it's somewhat discouraging if you look at history, because we've had three depressions, really, since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century. And let me just explain that you don't get depressions with mass unemployment in pre-modern agrarian societies. You may have famines, you know, the crops may fail. But it's only when you get industrial societies where there can be a mismatch between the goods produced and the customers who want the goods, leading to mass unemployment. So you begin to get these business cycles culminating in depressions and not just ordinary recessions, you know, once you get a machine economy. And the first one was from the 1870s to the 1890s. The second was the 1930s and 40s. And this is really a depression. We call it a recession. And its effects are moderated somewhat by the safeguards we assembled in the aftermath of the last depression, like unemployment insurance. But it really is a depression. And if you look at these two earlier experiences of depression, countries did not collaborate in order to boost demand. Instead, what they did was they engaged in a trade war and, in some cases, actual war. You had the scramble for Africa and the Middle East by the European empires trying to create markets for their own producers at the expense of other nations in the 1890s and 1900s. And then, of course, you had the rise of fascism and fascist and Nazi and Japanese imperialism in World War II. So there was a brief period following the crash of 2008 where the major countries agreed to have a joint stimulus of their economy. But since then, they've basically been engaged in a beggar thy neighbor attempt to export their own unemployment by running trade surpluses, by devaluing their currencies, by subsidizing their own industries. And it's hard for me to see where there will be a political base in these countries for the kind of combined international coordinated stimulus spending which we really need.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Lind, the author of the new book just out, Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. So what about, though, your book points out how technology-driven change leads to a growing misalignment between an innovative economy and anachronistic legal and political structures. The innovative economy we have now seems to me to be the death of capitalism, and that is the growing financialization of our economy. We no longer produce products, jobs, and wealth. We have Wall Street, where they trade bits of paper barrels of oil back and forth, rise the price of oil up by 40%, and gouge the consumer, providing absolutely nothing except pain to an economy that's desperately needing to recover. I just wonder how long the extraction model of capitalism, the one that Mitt Romney is the poster boy, how long that's sustainable.
Well, I don't think it is sustainable, but you have to bear in mind that it is the equal and opposite, the complement of the other model of countries like Germany, Japan, and China. If you look at the bubble economy that lasts really from the 1980s up until 2008, the United States agreed, more or less implicitly, to be the consumer for the rest of the industrial world. And so Germany, China, and Japan, which if you add their economies together, equals that of the United States, ran perpetual merchandise trade surpluses, exporting both to the U.S., but also in the case of Germany, to its European neighbors. So the U.S. had a kind of very strange specialized capitalism where we specialized in borrowing money indirectly from these surplus economies like China, buying American government debt and also buying a private debt. So the U.S. specialized in consumption fueled by debt. The mercantilist countries, that's the technical term for it, countries that try to run perpetual export surpluses like China, Germany, and Japan, specialized in government business strategies to prop up their export industries at the expense of the wages of their own people. And that was true in Germany as well as in China. In Germany, workers did not enjoy the benefits of economic growth. It's less unequal than the United States, but wages were suppressed in order to promote their export industries in these mercantilist countries. So if the U.S. model of financialized, debt-based consumption capitalism, and it's that model, by the way, which allowed this huge overgrowth of the financial sector, because if Americans hadn't been borrowing and paying interest charges, then the banking sector would be much smaller than it is. If that American financialized capitalism collapses, then so does the demand for this German, Japanese, Chinese, highly industrialized, over-industrialized, in fact, because one of the problems is, on a global scale, not in the United States, we've lost a lot of industry. But on a global scale, there's too much industry compared to the people who can afford to buy its products. So thanks to government subsidization, particularly in China, global industry has been overbuilt, even while it's been declining in the United States. And since these two systems were parasitic and interlocked, each needed the other one in order to function, then when the American financialized, debt-driven economy crumbles, so does that of the other industrial countries, which was based on the opposite model, targeting the U.S. And similar countries with consumption-based capitalism.
Let me remind the audience again, if I may, that I'm speaking with Michael Lind, who is the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He is the author of the new book just out, Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. So obviously the mantra that you have to cut taxes to stimulate the economy and that the wealthy, the 1%, are the job creators, that is discredited. The job creators are an affluent middle class who can buy products. You also said the other myth that has to be shattered as well is the kind of Bill Clinton neoliberal myth of getting everybody going to university. And I recall during the Republican primaries, Rick Santorum accused Obama of being a snob because he felt people should get an education. What are the ways that we can employ people? And I'm assuming that we're trapped in an economic system where people have to have wages in order to create demand and they have to buy products. And unless we all turn into hippies and live in a commune and get off corporate food and get off the corporate grid, what's the alternative?
Well, it's a real challenge because you're seeing, and this in the long term, there's going to be a shift out of manufacturing into service sector jobs, in particular personal service jobs that can't be outsourced for many low-skill Americans. As factories become more automated, even if we bring back some of the factories that have been lost to foreign trade practices, you're going to have increasingly automated production. And that's true of mining, it's true of agriculture. You're going to have a much more robotic economy. And so there will be jobs, but they will be in the areas of health and education and of amenities and recreation. If you think about it, Facebook is kind of a form of recreation, frankly. I mean, I don't think it adds a great deal to productivity, but it's entertainment. But so that's perfectly fine. As nations and as individuals get wealthier, they spend more and more on personal services, including dining out and tourism, and because the cost of appliances gets cheaper and cheaper, thanks to productivity growth. That's all quite natural. But the question is, if we're going to have a service sector majority, are they going to be a well-paid middle class, or are they going to be poorly paid working poor? And our whole policy of the last 20 or 30 years has been to crush unions, to allow inflation to eat away at the minimum wage, which would be $11 or $12 an hour now if it had been adjusted for inflation from the 60s, cutting back on benefits. So the fact is, these things are within the power of particular countries to address, and different countries may address them differently. So one country may subsidize the wages of service sector workers. Another may require a living wage, you know, a much higher minimum wage. A third may provide much more public services so that low-wage workers get subsidized goods, let's say, you know, free health care or free child care, that sort of thing. And it's just, it's a debate we should be having, but we're not having it because a lot of the progressives, so-called, as well as conservatives, have bought into this idea that wages and living standards are determined purely by markets. There's something called the free market out there, when in fact, whether your majority is paid well or not, has a great deal to do with the institutions of your country, including labor institutions and public policies.
But obviously, the disparity in wealth is stark and growing, and it's a global phenomenon in terms of the 1%. As opposed to the 99%, at least in the industrial world. I guess it's always been that way in the third world. So I'm trying to figure out why it is that we can't have a... I mean, what is driving this? My understanding in many ways is that capital is the beneficiary of increased productivity, whereas labor is not, and that the household income and productivity used to track in parallel, and then starting with Ronald Reagan, they've started to diverge.
That's right, but it's not a result of technology. It's a result of institutions. So where they diverge in the United States... it's because of institutional reforms that took place in the U.S., but not necessarily in other industrial countries. So you get a private sector unionization collapses from about a third in the 1950s to less than 7% today. As I said, inflation eroded the minimum wage. You've had a transformation of corporate culture. Because of in the 1970s and 80s, corporate executives start getting stock options, which are supposed to align their interests with those of the company. In fact, they align the interests of corporate managers with the billionaire plutocratic class rather than their own workers. So if you look at countries like Canada and like Britain and like Germany, where those sorts of reforms did not take place, you get much less polarization and much less inequality. It does increase to some extent. I'm not denying that. But much of the inequality in the United States is not the result of inevitable technological factors. It has to do with rigged systems of corporate compensation. In the case of high-paid doctors and lawyers, it has to do with rigged licensing systems where the supply is artificially kept small to drive up fees. A lot of, you know, one of the great frauds on the public is that the well-organized special interests in the United States and elites have essentially trashed the working class majority for a generation. And then when they're caught, they say, we didn't do it. The market did it. Globalization did it. Technology did it. Anybody but us. Because if you blame it on an impersonal global force, that means there's nothing you can do about it, which is what they want you to believe.
Well, now they're so in your face in the sense that, you know, with the Ryan budget, they're basically, the elites are basically saying, or at least the hirelings in the Congress are saying, oh, and Pete Peterson, who's funding a lot of this propaganda, saying, oh, you know, the middle class and the working people in this country have had it too good.
Yeah, that's right.
We've got to cut back on Social Security. Right. It's the only way we're going to deal with the deficit. You know, Medicare is, you know, et cetera. I mean, it's an amazing... Now, Michael Lind, in your book, the new book, Land of Promise and Economic History of the United States, you go back to the founding and to what seems to be a perennial struggle between Hamilton's and Jefferson's competing vision. How much is inequality in the DNA of the country? Because it certainly, to just a cursory look at the Civil War, it seemed like the South was about a kind of a plutocratic plantation economy and the North was about a more inclusive economy.
Well, that's true, but we shouldn't idealize the past too much. The United States was always very highly inegalitarian, and even in the Civil War, rich Northerners could pay for poor guys to be substitutes for their own rich kid sons, so they could sit out of the war. You could buy your way out of the draft, and you've had at least local and regional elites, North, South, and Midwest, have always had a very large share of the money. Really, the one period in American history when you get a compression of inequality, it's from the New Deal up until the 1970s. And you find a similar phenomenon in the rest of the industrial world. It wasn't limited to the United States. And it just had to do with, for one thing, you had universal suffrage. So that it's only after World War I, for example, in Britain, that you get a universal adult male voting. And it's only with the Civil Rights Revolution in the United States that you get a true universal suffrage in the United States in the 1960s and 70s. And so people simply vote for policies that will give them higher wages and more incomes and better benefits. And at the same time, the elites were frightened in the Western world by the rise of fascism and the attraction of communism in the 1930s and by World War II. And so you had a generation after World War II, even if they were otherwise fairly conservative, they weren't necessarily terribly enlightened, but they just thought for their own self-interest. They had to make sure you didn't have miserable people the U.S. and in the Western countries. And I think what happened was you got a generation of wealthy people who came to age and they simply didn't remember the Depression and World War II and fascism. They thought this was, you know, this they read about in the history books or their parents or grandparents told them about it. And I think, frankly, they're committing suicide. They're committing political suicide because I don't think there's a danger in the long run that you're going to have a plutocracy that can last for any amount of time because plutocracies tend to be the most despised elites, right? You know, since they haven't gained their eminence by serving the country, by serving in the military, they don't have any particular religious distinction, you know, religion being one of the other bases of authority. They're not necessarily great benefactors of the arts. So all of the things that traditional elites do to promote their legitimacy, people who just make their money on Wall Street by having computer programs that arbitrage changes in currencies, you know, they're really fundamentally lacking in legitimacy. So the question is, at some point, there will be a backlash, and they'll be reined in. The problem, if you're a progressive, is the backlash may not take liberal and democratic forms. Right, it can be some kind of illiberal populism of the right or of the left, and I think there's real danger of that. And you can see elements of it in Europe already with this backlash against the technocratic pro-austerity elites. It's a healthy backlash, by the way. I mean, but you just want to make sure that it isn't channeled into international competition and into illiberal populism instead of into constructive progressive forms.
And I thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and the policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's the author of a number of books, including Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, and The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. His latest book just out is Land of Promise, an economic history of the United States. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the organizer of a whistleblowing conference taking place in Washington, D.C., along with the author of The Whistleblower's Survival Guide, a handbook to committing the truth. Mm-hmm.